Okay, so I wasn't supposed to be preaching this morning, but I'm a stand-in for Joe, who did his first sermon a few weeks ago, and it's not despite all the chatter on the internet, not because he breached our theological guidelines in his first sermon. It was a cracking sermon. It was a hard sermon because it was on the Bride of Christ, but he is snowed under with work and with schedules and deadlines, so I said that I would do a little sermonette. And of course, what happens is when I start preparing a sermon, it never becomes a sermonette, but hopefully there'll be a chance for discussion. There will be a chance for discussion. And the idea was for me just to do a recap, because I am preaching next week, continuing our series on desire. And like the rabbit hole that it is, that I'm going down with desire, it will be an extended period of preaching this on this series. But today will be mainly a recap of where we've got up to and a chance to embed a few more ideas and thoughts around what we've done already, but also do some discussion, do two lots of discussion, actually, hopefully. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to do a little bit of recap, what we've done particularly from a couple of weeks ago, and then we'll be doing some discussion. So what we know is that we are desiring creatures who are made by a God who has desired us into existence, desired the whole creation into existence. And desire is part of our DNA. It's normal, it's natural, and it's necessary. And we are primarily lovers because God is a lover. And we long and we yearn and we love and we engage in habits and rituals. And we've called them liturgies of love, liturgies of desire, which show us and show the world what we love. This is all humans as well as us as Christians. And we live in a desire economy. The world around us, there is a domination system of desire, which is behaviour influencing, it's habit forming and it's culture shaping. And it disciples our desires. Our desires are shaped by the world around us as much as other influences. And so desires, our desires are not neutral. They may be normal, necessary and natural, but they're not neutral. They're God-given, but they are curated and discipled. The Amazon wish list is where we park a lot of our desires. Now, if I were to ask you to open up your Amazon wish list, it'll be interesting to see what's in there. Mine's just mainly books, hundreds and hundreds of books, as if I need any more, which Lorna says I don't, of course, but I still want some, and I can't bring myself to buy them at the moment, so it gives me a sense of comfort that they're in my Amazon wish list, and I'm not going to forget that they're there, and I might like to buy them someday. So we have a strange relationship with desire. Someone called it, Elizabeth Oldfield, who I'm reading quite a lot and listening to quite a lot at the moment, she calls it a disability of desire. And the Christian world and our discipleship has contributed to the disability of our desire. Because we fail to understand, we fail to hear, listen to, and to admit and name our desires and our passions and our yearnings and our wants. What our soul wants and longs for. The deepest desires within us. We are also, I talked about a couple of weeks ago, we are teleological creatures. That means our longings, our passions, our yearnings and our wants are aimed at something. They have a direction to them. They have an end, a telos, a goal. All our desires have a vision. They are orientated towards something. Orientation. Now at school, I used to hate orientation. You know, when you were going out and you were saying, we're doing some orienteering, I just absolutely hated orienteering. I don't know why we even did it. I mean, as a teenager, all I was interested in was playing football, climbing trees, listening to music and snogging women. Girls, anyway, not women. And I was, you know, I did that up until about 27. No. And no, I didn't want to be reading a map and a compass and, you know, the forest was there to climb trees, not to find a marker and look at a map and all that kind of stuff. But orienteering is understanding the picture that you have in front of us and the goal you've got to get to and how you get to it. And as teleological creatures, we have our deepest desires and a picture of what life looks like and how to get there. And we'll come on to that in a moment. And humans are obviously not unique in the desires they have. The animal kingdom has lots of desires. Dogs, of course, want to have a stick and throw the stick to them. They chase the stick and they bark and they jump and they do whatever. A sloth, for example, wants to have a good branch to sleep on. A cat wants a good scratch. In my book, cats need a good kicking, but that's just my preference against cats. Now, I don't know if you're listening to this online, I don't endorse violence against cats or indeed any animals. They are God's creatures. I just don't like cats. They're wicked. But as one of the books I've been reading by A.J. Swoboda, he says this: fish don't crave respect. Ants don't march against injustice. Amoebas don't long for forgiveness or equality. It is humans that have a special, unique desire for certain desires. And we've been talking about the book by James K. Smith, Desiring the Kingdom. And he said that these certain desires, these unique desires, are about what we love and a specific vision of the good life, an implicit picture of what we think human flourishing looks like. And we're going to examine this in a moment. And this picture that we have in our minds, all of us have this picture in our minds, it's in our hearts and in our gut and in our imagination, what human flourishing looks like in the good life. And it encompasses our family, our relationships, our work, our politics, our leisure activities, where we live, how we use our money. And this vision of the good life, of human flourishing, captures our heart, it animates and arouses our imagination, and it orders and orientates our desires towards that vision. And so therefore, we have certain expectations about how our desires for the good life can be satisfied. We all have a way to orientate ourselves towards that goal. And we ask ourselves in the course of this series, who or what is shaping, discipling, curating those desires? And that is crucial. And what is the good in the good life that James K. Smith talks about? And we explored a couple of weeks ago the good that God pronounces over creation in the Genesis narrative. And I said good. In Hebrew, the word was, can anybody remember, apart from Chrissy, because she'll know this, it was good is, begins with T, three, tov, yes, good is tov. God pronounced the creation he made as tov and humans as very tov. I looked at two particular aspects of how we define good from that Genesis narrative. Can anybody tell me what those two aspects are of the word good? Anybody? Is anybody there? She's really encouraging, you know. It's 2 weeks ago. But anyway, so we looked at the division, first of all, of the land of the sea, the skies, the water, above and below, the light and the dark. And it came from the disorder, the formless and void, the welter and waste of the world, the cosmos at that time. And good was pronounced when God ordered all those things. So there was an ordering. Did you say that, Nikki? Did you?
Wait, it's coming back to me now.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Yeah, yeah. The harmony, the equilibrium. That's what good starts with when God pronounced it. He orders the world that existed that was in chaos, the waters of chaos. And he orders them and gives harmony and balance and equilibrium. The second aspect is what? Life had to do something. What did it do? Grow. Yes. Reproduce, multiply, auto-generate. Plants and trees and vegetation flourished. So good is when flourishing and reproduction happens of the natural world of humans and all living things, even cats. And it's good. So, the first question I want you to answer, and you've got pens on your table, and Chrissy's going to give out the first question on an A3 sheet, everybody's going to have one, is this. What is your vision of the good life? Consider the definition that I've put forward from Genesis. So first of all, good is harmony, order, equilibrium, balance. It is also flourishing. It is also multiplication and reproduction, flourishing of human life. And list the things which defines the good life in your world. Personally, work, societal, whatever. Okay? What constitutes the good life according to this definition? Okay, let's have some feedback from some of the things on your list. Chrissy, if you're able to pass the roving mic around when people prompted, that'd be great. So, who would like to start describing some of the things from your list? Come on now. Hello.
I should know how to work a mic, but there you go. We talked about, like, overall wanting in life to look at kind of worship and wonder and integrity, and then that kind of came into talking about more specific around love and kindness and being godlike. I talked about, but we kind of shared in that I just really want to show love and be shown the same love in return, and that's about community and building community with one another and looking at creation and our contribution to creation as well. So that was kind of it.
Very, very holy orientated. Very good, very good, thank you. Okay. Yeah, we are. Yeah, yeah. This is not so holy. I can see where that's coming from. Go on, anybody else? Excellent. Good start. Follow that. Come on. Name it.
If I just list the words and something might resonate.
Okay? Yeah.
So openness, harmony, justice, nurture, flourishing, fun, hope, creativity, peace, equality, joy, understanding, fellowship and community, beauty, security, energy, agency, activity.
You don't want much, do you? Excellent. Thank you. Good. So I have all those things. How are we going to get there?
Yeah, it reminds me of the card I was writing on the front. Everyone was asked, you know, what do you really want? And it was world peace. And then you open the card and it says, no, really, it's thin and thighs. But we haven't listed that. I'm going to do the same with the words that we chose. We've got harmony, justice, respect, kindness, health, wonder, enough, like in having enough, wholeness, love, family in terms of relationships and community.
Okay. Great. Anybody else wants to share anything before we move on? You?
I suppose that everything's been covered apart from learning opportunities. Trees, time to rest, good sleep, and variety of experiences, food, and balancing that with routine.
Okay.
Most of the opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. Anything on the table over there? Hang on, let's just get you on mic. We need this, Paul.
Sorry, we looked at it a little bit differently. So, I mean, we had a big long list of what do we want to make us personally fulfilled. And then we thought, well, what does that mean in the context of a good life? And a good life, and we talked a little bit about Genesis. I mean, you've got the idea of balance, light and dark. Good things happen, bad things happen. And you actually grow through challenges quite often. If everything goes exactly as you want it, you don't develop, you don't progress. So I went off on a bit of a tangent.
It's very important, Paul. That's an interesting point about the place of pain in the garden.
And we talked about three words, which I think we all desire, but are quite contextual how we... One is success, a kind of sense of success in something we do, but that another one is contentment, and the other one is purpose. But that's different things for different people.
Yeah, it is. We could look
at who we regard as being very successful, and they may think they're absolute failures. We may look at someone and we think that, I feel a bit sorry for them, but they may be really content with their life. And so it's quite a subjective thing, but I think deep inside of us, we all want to experience those things.
Thank you, Vince. Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on a little bit and just recap a few other things and add a few things extra to that. In the process of trying to... So this is the telos. They are teleological creatures. So these are the goals of our desires. We've got to understand how we get there and how much of what we long for, and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, is either idealistic or just impossible. And we've got to also consider the pursuit of this life, what it actually does to us, what we are pursuing, how it actually forms us in the process of pursuing these things. If you are achieving or want to achieve a certain goal in life, there may be a cost involved. How much we lose in our yearning, how much we gain in our wanting. And probably even to be slightly self-critical about the way in which when we are filled with what one writer, Chris Green, has called an unholy dissatisfaction with the life we already have and the implications for that unholy dissatisfaction. Because dissatisfaction can be quite good. It could a restlessness, a yearning for something greater and better and better for all is a good thing. But when that trips into being an unholy dissatisfaction, it may involve discontentment, like you've spoken about, Vince. So, to go back to the trees thing, it was a tale of two trees in the Garden of Delights. And we're just going to read this phrase to recap from Genesis 2. The Lord God made all kinds of trees to grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So, when very good humans met the good creation, there was desire. Desire happened at the heart of the Garden of Delights, because things were pleasing to look at. They were good for food. Humans recognised what they saw as good for them, i.e. order, harmony, nourishment, sustenance, flourishing, would come from seeing, taking and eating. And so there was permission and consent. The first words recorded in the Bible from the command of God to humans were, "You are free. You are free to eat." And this was a different version, "From every tree in the garden, you must surely eat." Another version say, "You are free to eat." The "surely eat," actually in Hebrew, is an idiom which actually just says, "eat, eat." So we've translated as "surely eat" or "must eat," but basically it said, "You must eat, 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 eat." It's a way to capture both the command, the importance of the command, and the type of activity that they were called to do, because they needed to flourish. And a good life was flourishing. And the tree of life, we said, represents God's own life. God as the ultimate and infinite source of goodness. So God has filled creation with attractive and desirable trees. They were icons of desire. Trees were these sort of tiny image-bearing divine icons of God's goodness. And we should eat, eat from them. But in the Garden of Delights was a garden of danger. represented by the equally attractive and desirable tree of knowing good and evil and knowing good and bad. And that is the tree of life in some of the pictures. And that is the tree of knowing good and evil. It's got apples on it. Oh, such a cliche. The two trees represent the choices and the consequences of what happens when humans follow the telos of their desires. So when they see and when they take and when they eat, one led to flourishing, multiplication, order, equilibrium and harmony. The other would lead to disconnection, dysfunction, disorder and death, health or harm. So when we see, take and eat, it is important. And from this morning, the emphasis that Jesus often takes in both the physical act of eating, but also to using it as a metaphor, is not an accident of eating from the table and eating from God's kingdom. And we'll come on to that in a couple of weeks. Is a side-by-side parallel metaphor that is going on throughout the whole of the Bible, but starts in Genesis, about the way that we consume things and consume in order to live a good life, or the consequences of consuming stuff which leads to the alternative life. So the danger is when we try to satisfy our desires from what looks like good for us, but actually represents a trespass against what God intends for us. And Tim Mackey from the Bible Society positioned the tree of life, as it says, in the centre of the garden, but also to get to the centre, you had to pass by the tree of knowing good and evil. So that tree represented the danger of distraction. And when our desires are distracted by other alternative versions of the good life, that's when there is danger. You see, our brains are wired for desire. We know that. But they're also programmed for reward. Most of you know that dopamine is a neurochemical transmitter and a hormone that's based in our brain. It's the body's own pleasure drug. And when our desires are satisfied, when we see, take and eat of something pleasurable, an experience, it may be a great meal, it may be some sunbathing, going in the sea, view from the mountaintop, it may be just a glass of wine or watching a great comedy show, it may be buying a new dress or a t-shirt on Vinted, and you get that dopamine hit. You're rewarded, your brain rewards you with a dopamine hit. And that makes us feel good. This is just the natural consequences of the way our bodies work. Our brain tells us to repeat that stimuli. Keep doing it because it's good for you. Pursue it, desire it, fulfill it, satisfy it. We've got this in our brains. And all these pleasure experiences scream at our brains, I am good for you. I will provide you with nourishment. It's the trees out there that are attractive and desirable. I can nourish you. I can satisfy you. And in our fast-paced world, where we are wired to visual stimuli, we are relentlessly bombarded by distracting icons of desire, trees of desire, which reward and reinforce this beneficial behaviour. When we do something, we get a hit, and so we want to naturally do it again and again and again. And of course, that is the pathway towards addiction. And in Genesis 3, there is a, which we'll come to in a couple of weeks, well, next week, there is a voice and a narrative which comes, which is crafty and cunning, Genesis says. I've called it cosmic spiritual clickbait. It is the idea that the serpent in the garden is an ally of the alternative possibilities presented to Adam and Eve to eat from another source of goodness, knowledge. And the serpent offers, in the clickbait headlines, a twisted narrative with enough truth in it to be plausible, tempting, and attractive. That is the power of distraction. That is the danger of distraction. And we know that we are a distracted people at this current moment in Western history. I was reading even today on the news where there was a headline that said, "Right Move is my pawn." There was an article that someone who's literally addicted 30 or 40 times a day by looking on Right Move and scrolling down. Scrolling, as we know, is the disease of distraction. And we are carrying around with us a distractive tool which we scroll down and which leads us towards these dopamine hits of Instagram likes, of following this, of looking on our Amazon wish list and whatever. And that is a tool of distraction. The mobile God that we played a couple of weeks ago, the song by James. And so they were distracted by this tree that was nevertheless present in this garden. And we've got to forget the language of perfection when we talk about Eden. And we've got to come to that some other time. But someone said that their imaginations were piqued by over-curiosity. Their desires were over-curious to lead them to ultimately, where it says here, and we'll go back to this, "But you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat it," remember, see, take and eat, "you will surely die." The same idiom, which now means, therefore, you will die. Excellent, yes. Eat, or die. The emphasis is the command not to eat and the consequences of what will happen when you do see, take, and eat it. And so, Elizabeth Oldfield, who I really do recommend this book, Fully Alive, by Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times. It's a really left-field take on the Seven Deadly Sins, and it's a really good book. And she talks about soul dangers, threats to flourishing and order of the soul. And we talked about a couple of weeks ago the wisdom that is required to recognise the dangers to our soul's flourishing. When we are constantly offered and distracted by visions and versions of the good life, which look attractive and desirable, but ultimately form us away from the people that we actually want to be and the people that we probably should be as the people of God. And so, as our final little bit, and we perhaps have got time for this. What is the time anyway, by the way? Have we got?
Almost 25 past.
Okay. Oh, you said that very confidently, as if I want to get out of here by 12:30, Mike. Almost 25 past. I'm going to carry on doing my knitting until we say so. It's crochet, isn't it?
It's knitting.
Is it knitting? Oh, I always get it wrong. Okay, so on your second piece of paper, Chrissy, please. Thank you. The final question, we're not going to do any more about this, I'm just going to read a poem after this. What are the alternative, attractive and desirable visions of the good life which society offers us but ultimately can distract us and lead us to disorder and ruin? Over to you. Okay, who would like to kick off this time to share some of your thoughts, please? Perhaps at that table over there, you can start. Paul, you're the spokesperson.
So we talk quite a bit about the whole idea of success and status. So obviously there's things like money and better car, job, house. Mm. And this whole idea that you always want more. Mm. So whatever you get, it's never quite enough. And we use like the Queen song, "I Want It All," that kind of idea.
Yeah.
And I was, Yeah. And I was thinking of that girl, Veruca, in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yeah.
She just wants more and more. She's never satisfied, and her dad's constantly buying her stuff, and she just wants another thing.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So, that's great.
And advertising just feeds that.
Yeah, yeah.
It tells us all the time, you haven't got enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And you need this. And it works on dissatisfaction.
Yeah, it does, yeah, yeah. The algorithms and advertising, yeah.
Yeah.
They're, when I say they're disciple makers, they are, because they are individual disciple makers. That's the power and the beauty of algorithms. You know, they curate a world for you. According to what you've looked at. So the world of advertising has taken an incredible turn over the last few years. It's amazing. Okay, anybody else?
Yes, we were looking at, so there's that image of having it all, you know, the house, the garden, the family, the pet, everything. But then another image that's offered to us is one which encompasses things like money and popularity and stuff, which is the partying, going out, having fun, lots of friends. There's the drinking. There's just all of this excess that sort of it, and it kind of can get into the psyche. This is like, I'm not okay unless this is part of my life. And so people can, what that can lead to, the distraction is the comparison and the dissatisfaction with who you are, like who God's created you to be, and what you have without any of that stuff, which is good and beautiful in itself, but you don't necessarily see that because you're taken up with this other vision.
Mm. And I think that's where the unholy dissatisfaction comes in.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Well, I think a lot of actually what's been said is about social comparison as well, isn't it? So I think that is the sort of the toxicity of social comparison, how we think we're not enough. And I think we talk about social media, talk about, and it depends, like you're talking about here, parties and other things, and in my world it's sort of academic citations, and are you really not simple? But that's toxic as well. So you've got all of these sorts of things, you know, that could be good, but draw you into this sort of like, that you're not enough, like you're saying. We talked about social media being that sort of thing of you're comparing your bloopers with other people's highlight reels, and that's what social media is about. So, yeah.
And that's important, because we want to affirm a good world, don't we? We want to affirm the good trees, and we say they are attractive and they are desirable and they've been made good. Okay, things have been corrupted and warped and twisted. But we don't want to be Christians or form into a church or Christianity which tries to avoid all these things. We want to engage with them, but understand them and understand the threat and the danger they represent in their goodness and how they can be used for good, but they also could be twisted for harm as well. So it is good for us to be able to sort of, like you say, they're good things. Anybody got anything to add? So a couple of weeks ago, I just read a poem from a short book I got ages ago by a poet called Ruth Wells. It's called Formation. So I thought I'd go back into the book to see if there was anything else that would be sort of fitting with this little sermonette that's turning into a little bit of a longer ramble. And it...
It's out of time.
Yes, that's right. Out of time. Bing, go home. This is called Takes the Biscuit, which is probably true for you, Eleanor. So let's use it as a prayer, if we can possibly take the biscuit. I'm redacted to the exacting standards of Instagram. Can I ever live up to? The answer is a sharp, short no. I know it's filters and effects, and I'm not indulging in quite so many biscuits, but the thing is, I like biscuits and carbs and crisps and chips. And I like to think that I am somewhat intelligent being, but I make this confession that I have been snapped into a trap with clickbait, and I hate to admit it. But I have followed that link that made me think a superfood was key to unlocking eternal skinniness, i.e. happiness. I'm a person who has that too small dress hung forlornly in the wardrobe, nostalgically waiting for that never-to-come day when I will fit in it again. But then this body, post-children, has a lot more room in it for happiness. This is a more spacious place for joy to live, for contentment to reside. And I have tried, and I will continue to try, but I am the lady who swallowed the lie. Perhaps it will die if I stop feeding it, and instead be fed on the fullness of life. And maybe I'll always have to strive to draw my eye away from those picture-perfect people, to resist the fallacy that all there is to me is this exterior, and that if my derriere reaches a certain size, I will realise self-fulfilment. So those Instagram standards can take a walk for a bit, because enjoying being me should surely take the biscuit. Amen.